just read from the prophecy of Isaiah and the 9th chapter. Isaiah chapter 9. You often find at Christmas these Old Testament prophecies of the Messiah are read, but they're not often considered or expounded. Isaiah chapter 9. Nevertheless, the bloom will not be upon her who is distressed. As when at first he lightly esteemed the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward more heavily oppressed her by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, in Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. You have multiplied the nation and increased its joy. They rejoice before you according to the joy of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. You have broken the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor as in the day of Midian, for every warrior's sandal from the noisy battle and garments rolled in blood will be used for burning and fuel of fire. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Amen. First, let's look again at that 9th chapter of Isaiah. The beginning of the chapter is describing a situation of hope when there isn't much grounds for hope. It says, nevertheless, in verse 1, the gloom will not be upon her who is distressed. As when at first he lightly esteemed the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward more heavily oppressed her by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan. Isaiah is describing a time in which the nation of Israel is going to be oppressed. Perhaps it's a reference to the exile, when the people of Israel are taken across the Jordan, taken away from their land. It says, in Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. The Bible often uses picture language and metaphor to describe spiritual things. And darkness in the Bible refers to, when it's a metaphor, to spiritual darkness. In Galilee of the Gentiles, Galilee at this time was a Gentile area. Now at the time of Christ, it had become part of the Jewish area. But at this point, it's a Gentile area. And as we know from the second of Romans, the Gentiles, the non-Jewish people, were people who had essentially rejected God and made up their own gods. They were idolaters. And if you go to the British Museum, or indeed any museum of the ancient world, you'll find hundreds and thousands of statues of gods and goddesses, sometimes of animals, sometimes of people, that were worshipped in the ancient world. Our days of the week are named after idols. The early Quakers refused to use days like Monday and Wednesday. They talk about the first day and the fifth day and the third day. Well, my conscience is not especially offended by the fact, but you might know that Wednesday is named after Woden, a Celtic god. Thursday is named after Thor, a Viking god. Saturday is named after Saturn, a Roman god. Now maybe some people will feel very uncomfortable now at using, oh, I'll meet you a week on Saturday. Well, let me assure you, there is no such god as Saturn, or Woden, or Thor. And the use of their names troubles me not. And yet it's evidence, is it not, of the fact that the human race descended so low that we rejected God and made up our own deities instead. The Gentiles were therefore a people of darkness, and they were walking in darkness. When you walk in the dark, it's very dangerous. I went walking a few weeks ago up Darwin Tower. It was a perfectly pleasant walk. It had been snowing, but it was snowy on the hills and the roads were clear. That's the kind of snow that I like. I can go up and find it if I want to. I can leave it there. It doesn't come down to my level or annoy me when I'm trying to get to work or church. But I think we had somewhat underestimated the length of the walk. And we were walking down the hill in darkness. And of course we had mobile phones and were shining them around, so it wasn't quite darkness. And yet you're conscious that when you're walking in the dark, a stone or a root suddenly becomes quite dangerous. Because you can't see it. And it will trip you. And here Isaiah describes Galilee of the Gentiles, this Gentile area, as being a place of darkness. The people who walked in darkness, but he says something wonderful, have seen a great light. Isaiah here is prophesying that the Messiah, although of course he would be born in Bethlehem, which is what the other prophecies said, would actually be linked to the area of Galilee, which is of course where he grew up. Those people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. It's not just any old light, it is they have seen the light of the world. Those who dwell in the land of the shadow of death. That's very powerful imagery. Those who dwelt in the land of the shadow of death. Every human being, bar a couple, we have dwelt, have we not, in the shadow of death. Only last week, a member of this congregation was taken. We have a graveyard to our ear. We are living in the shadow of death. We are, to use Isaiah's correct expression, living in the land of the shadow of death. And yet those who live in shadow, upon them, a light has shined. And the great news of the gospel is that even if we're living in the land of the shadow of death, Christ is our light. That even through the gloom, and even through the darkness, and even through death itself, he is and he will shine. In verse 3, Isaiah says, "You have multiplied the nation and increased its joy. They rejoice before you according to the joy of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil." Imagine a more agricultural society than our own. And all year you've been waiting and working for the harvest, and now you've finally gathered it in. You will survive the winter. You will survive the spring. You will survive the summer because the harvest is in. Think of the joy of those harvesters. Well, Isaiah is saying, there is a joy coming which will be like the harvesters at the time of harvest. Even like those who divide the spoil and the plunder. He says, "You have broken the yoke of his burden and the staff of his shoulder, the rod of the oppressor, as in the days of Midian." Midian was an old enemy of Israel at the time of Gideon, that were oppressing the people of Israel. And God threw off their burden. He broke their yoke. Isaiah is saying, something similar, though something greater, is going to happen again. For every warrior's sandal from the noisy battle, and garments rolled in blood will be used for burning and fuel the fire. Here we have another picture of this gospel age which Isaiah has seen through the revealing of the Holy Spirit. The time is coming when everything that causes bloodshed and violence and war and death will itself be consumed. Even the sandal worn by the warrior, as well as his bloody garments, will be thrown in the fire. Isaiah is using this as a metaphor for peace. And in verse 6 and 7, upon which I wish to concentrate, we have the means by which the earlier part of the chapter will be fulfilled. So Isaiah says, hope is coming to those without hope. Light is coming to those who are in darkness. Light is coming to those who dwell in the shadow of death. Joy is coming, like as a harvest. And peace is coming when people know war anymore. And so we come to verse 6. It says, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. A child is, in many respects, the very weakest type of human being. It lacks knowledge, it lacks strength. It will grow up into an adult. It says, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. Isaiah is indicating that these prophecies will be fulfilled with the coming of a child. Of course, he doesn't say a child. That's the difficulty with Christmas and carol services, which I have, is that they're often talking about the birth of a baby, and they forget the fact that the baby grew up. The baby became a man. That man was crucified and resurrected, and therein lies our salvation. Nevertheless, he came as a child. Isaiah 53 and verse 2 reads, he grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. John chapter 1 verse 1 makes it absolutely clear that Jesus Christ was not just an ordinary human being. He was God himself. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. When you look in literature for children or Christmas cards, baby Jesus and the Mary and Joseph, they're always very good looking, aren't they? In fact, if you look at Victorian art, or even from the 1950s and before, they look incredibly European, with their blonde hair and blue eyes. Well, that I doubt. And I doubt he walked around with a halo. In fact, if you saw this child born, or this child growing up, you would have thought nothing of it. He was just another child. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. Nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. Isaiah spells out the means by which the benefits of the first part of the chapter are going to be obtained. And the means so far is the birth of a child, albeit a male child, a son. I said before, just a few moments ago, that when Jesus came, he was God. He wasn't like God, he wasn't just a prophet of God, he wasn't just close to God, he was God himself. And yet he was also a human. Christians in about the 3rd or 4th century had difficulty with this. Some of them thought, well, he must just have been a human. Others said, no, he wasn't a human, he was just God, pretending to be a human. Well, the Bible is absolutely clear, he was 100% human and 100% divine. He was a child. He didn't come as a man, he came as a child, born of a woman. He grew up. If he fell over, he bled. When he bled, he cried. He slept, he grew tired. He was vulnerable like every other human. And yet there is something remarkable about this child. Unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder. This is a royal child. A child who will reign. A child who will rule. There have been times in the history of the Bible and in the history of our own country where the heir to the throne has ascended the throne while still a child. I think of Edward the VI. Henry VIII died while I think he was 9 years old, and he became age 9. Edward VI, by the way, I think was a genuinely saved young man. You read what he writes, you read his beliefs. He was a genuine son of the Reformation. Nevertheless, the Lord saw fit to call him home, I think when he was 15 years old. There are times in the Bible when young men have ascended the throne. But this child is different. He's not just a royal child who takes the throne before his time. He's somewhat unique. In Psalm 2, which is a psalm about the Messiah, it says, you will break them with a rod of iron. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. And that is echoed also in the second of Revelation. Of Christ, it says, he shall rule them with a rod of iron. As the vessels of a potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I received of my Father. The Bible has a kind of love-hate relationship with kings. There are kings that have been appointed by God. We should obey the king, the Old Testament says. And it also says, it's better to trust in the Lord than put confidence in princes, writes the psalmist in 118. Yet here is a ruler. Here is a monarch. He's not just a ruler, but the government shall be upon his shoulders. He will carry government. He will be the source of government. He will be the foundation of government. Why? Because he is the creator. He's not just another prince. He's not just another young monarch. The government will be upon his shoulders. The government of where? The government of whom? Well, when you become a Christian, you accept the government of Christ. We pride ourselves, do we not, of being free. And there are many people on planet Earth today who are not free. Their government tells them what to do and tells them what to think and tells them how they can think it. But when you become a Christian, you surrender the government of your life. You surrender the government of your finances. You surrender the government of your household to Christ. The government will be upon his shoulders, the government of us, but also, of course, the government of this world. When he returns, every knee will bow and every tongue confess that Jesus is Lord. And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor. He's not sure whether there should be a comma between Wonderful Counselor. Is he simply Wonderful and the Counselor, or is he a Wonderful Counselor? I suspect it makes no difference. But at the time, Isaiah is writing, perhaps under the reign of King Ahaz, a wicked king, a bad king, a selfish king, a corrupt king. Isaiah is looking forward to the time when the government will be upon the shoulder of a Wonderful Counselor, a man who governs with wisdom, a king who reigns with fairness. An unrelated passage in 2 Samuel chapter 16 talks of Ahithophel. He says, which he counseled in those days was as if a man inquired at the oracle of God. Here is a strange Old Testament character who, when you approach him, is like approaching God himself. His counsel is wonderful. Well, Christ is the Wonderful Counselor because when we approach him, we approach the very lively oracles of God. We approach God himself, for he is God, which is Isaiah's next expression. He is wonderful, he is counselor, he is wise, he is also the mighty God. He's not just a representative of God, he's not just a prophet or an ambassador or a clergyman or a preacher. He is mighty God himself. He's not some cheap tuck in the aisle. God himself will be this child. God himself will be this son. Deuteronomy chapter 10 verse 17 reads, for the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, a great God, mighty and terrible, which regardeth not persons nor taketh reward. Sometimes I wonder why in the Bible, when they're talking of God, do they need to put the mighty God? God itself contains all those ideas of mightiness within it. And yet it's a reminder to us that this child, born, would be mighty God. Far greater than anyone else on that planet at that time. Be it Herod in the palace or the Magi bringing gifts, the child was greater than all of them. Because the child is mighty God. And it goes on, the everlasting Father. and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father. Here is one who predates history. Here is one, although he is born, yet he is the Father. The Creator takes on the likeness of a human being. Remember what Jesus said to the Jews before Abraham was, I am. Christ was there before the creation of the world. Nothing was made except through him, for by him all things are made. How can a child be a father? Because this child is the Creator. Let me read to you at length, John chapter 1 verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. In him we live and breathe and have our being. The Father, the Creator of humanity, became a human being. Then Isaiah goes on to give him one of his most famous titles and expressions. He is the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Isaiah looked forward in verse 5 to the day when the garments and even the shoes of the warrior will be burned, because they will be required no more. The days of fighting, the days of rebellion, the days of quarreling, the days of war will be over. And in the 4th of Micah, Micah writes, and he shall judge among many peoples and rebuke strong nations afar off. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. In one respect, I believe that prophecy is yet to be fulfilled. Because you can turn on the news at any time and it will tell you about war here or war there. But I believe when Jesus returns, war will be no more. And yet at the same time, the prophecy of Micah and the prophecy of Isaiah, he will be the Prince of Peace, has been fulfilled and is being fulfilled. You see, you were born into a state of rebellion against God. We were born at war with God and everything he stands for. But Paul writes in the 5th of Romans, therefore, having been justified by faith, we have peace with God. Because of the gospel, because of the good news, sinful men and women naturally inclined to be hostile to God and all that is righteous and find peace with him. Because we have surrendered to his government and accepted his terms. We're looking at Hebrews 9 in the Bible studies. It's now going to be our third week on it, but it is a rich vein of scripture. And in chapter 9, verse 19, the writer says, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? When you've done something wrong, quite often the conscience will keep pricking you and oining you because of what you've done. And dead works do nothing to purge the conscience. But the blood of Christ can. And maybe you've done something in your dim and distant past of which you are ashamed and you cannot find peace. Well, Isaiah the prophet says to you, one was born, who is the Prince of Peace, that because of his blood shed at Calvary, even the human conscience can be cleansed and peace given. Verse 7 elaborates on the previous verse. It says, of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no ends. The government, I don't wish to become political, For over the past few hundred years, governments have constantly expanded. They've expanded their power, they've expanded their finances. A few hundred years ago, the government thought its job was merely to prevent foreign invasion and to enforce what few laws we had. Now the state does much more. The state provides us with education. The state will provide us with healthcare. It provides us with care when we're old and we need help. And I say, thank goodness for that. But now we're looking at the point whereby the state is wanting to know what we're teaching our children in Sunday school. Lest we radicalise them. Well, if we can teach our children to be radical for Christ, how will we be good? Nevertheless, here is a description of a government which does keep increasing. And the peace also keeps increasing. How is the government increasing? The government of Christ, the increase of his government. Well, every time somebody becomes a Christian, the government of Christ is increased. The more a Christian wants to bow their knee to him and allow him to rule their lives, allows him to make the decisions, allows him to be sovereign in all we say, in all we think and all we do, his government does increase, and with it so does peace. Have you ever noticed that? The more we hand over to God, the more control he has in our life, the more peace we have. And the more I try to manage, the more worried I become. Because the increase of his government is linked to the increase of peace. It says there shall be no end. As the gospel continues to spread throughout the world, his government will increase and so will the peace. He says, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom. Here we get a glimpse more into how Christ would be. He would be royal. He would be of the line of David. He would be a king. He has his own kingdom. He's likened to David. David is a picture of him. He's like David, but he's better than David. Last week we looked at how David fell walking on his rooftop. He didn't trip up because he was walking in the dark. He tripped up spiritually because he turned off the light. And he committed adultery with Bathsheba. And he ended up killing her husband. Here is a king like David's, but he's better. Great David's greater son. Joseph was descended from David, and so Christ, being legally his child, was deemed a descendant of David upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom to order it and to establish it with justice and judgment. Israel is disorderly and it is unjust. But a king is coming who will be fair and will be orderly and will impose that order. It says from henceforth, even forever. This is not a temporary project. This is not something for a particular time. Isaiah is seeing something wonderful which will have ramifications throughout the whole of eternity. This child, this son who is being born, the consequences of his coming will be eternal. From henceforth, even forever. And then you think, well, how can this be achieved? Will it be achieved? A child. A son being born. So maybe the original readers of Isaiah's prophecy are reading it, and maybe Isaiah's there, and some of them are saying, hold on, Isaiah, are you sure this is going to happen? You know, the nation is in the state, Ahaz is king, there's idols everywhere, and you're telling us there's hope for those living in the shadow of death, there's hope for those living in darkness. We'll have joy like the reapers at harvest. The days are coming when even the clothes of the warrior will no longer be needed, all because of a child. Well, as if to preempt such talk, it says, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. God has determined it. God is determined that the salvation of the Jew and of the Gentile will be from the child which has been prophesied in Isaiah chapter 9. Now we know it's not just his childhood, it was his perfect adult life, his death and resurrection, which achieved salvation. Nevertheless, Christ came as a second and final Adam. A real human being. Like the first Adam, he was born of the woman. 1 Peter chapter 1 verse 20 we read, he was chosen before the creation of the world, but was revealed in these last times for your sake. This wasn't just some last minute plan God had concocted in order to put things right. Christ was chosen before the creation of the world, and in Revelation chapter 13, he talks of the Lamb who was slain from the creation of the world. From henceforth, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. And he did. And he does. And he shall do. And so in closing, let's go back to those promises of Isaiah. People who walk in darkness, you can now walk in light. You who dwell in the shadow of death, you who are afraid to die, your fear can be no more, for a light has shined. Those of you who are working, the time is coming, and the time has come, when the harvest arrives, and those who are oppressed can throw off their oppressor, because peace is coming. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Amen.